The battered ships met in mid-ocean, but there were more storms and repeated snapping of the cable, not to mention the attacks by a whale and a layover in Ireland while the cable was repaired and fresh coal was taken aboard. Nevertheless, Captain Pretty was damned if he was going to pull his ship out if the Yanks on the Niagara were going ahead. The U.S. captain, of course, reciprocated his views, which their respective seamen had no doubt emphasized to one another when they'd met for polite, articulate discussion at various waterfront pubs during the Irish break. And then, late in July 1858, the weather cleared, and for more than a week the Atlantic was as calm as an inland pond. The Niagara's cable was pulled ashore in Newfoundland, and the Agamemnon's dragged up to Valentia Bay in Ireland. As the news of the August 5th landing came out, the newspapers went wild. This was harmony within the dominant Anglo-Saxon breed. This was technology conquering the planet, and suitable celebrations were in order. In Britain, church bells were decorously rung. Knighthoods were granted, including one to Chief Engineer Charles Bright, only 26 years old, and a formal congratulation from the Queen was printed in the Times. In America, there were cannon barrages, preachers taking credit for the achievement, and torchlit parades. Hence the unfortunate incident in which a lit torch met the highly combustible cupola atop New York City Hall. Field was a hero, and Whitehouse, who quickly took up position in the telegraph hut in Ireland, kicking out Thompson, who'd started connecting the wires before he arrived, was now going to be his prophet. For there were dozens of messages stacking up waiting to be telegraphed, and although the first few had been transmitted with no difficulty by Thompson, Whitehouse was determined to get credit for the rest. He soon came to the greatest one, the formal congratulation from Queen Victoria to President Buchanan. The Newfoundland telegraph transcribers were ready. Special correspondents from U.S. newspapers were standing by as well. But something was wrong. The first telegrams had been transmitted without flaw, but now it seemed as if something inside the cable was changing. The Queen's telegram was only 99 words, and a skilled operator could have tapped it out in a few minutes. Yet hours passed, there were hushed reports of members of field staff hurrying grimly in and out of the telegraph huts, and only well into the next day, after 16.5 exhausting hours of transmission, did the full text make it through. The telegrapher's efforts went downhill from there. It took more than 30 hours of struggle with sending and resending to transmit Buchanan's equally brief telegram back to the Queen. Surviving documents show that the cable was increasingly taken up with messages of "send more slowly," or "repeat," or, most plaintive of all, long repeats of "what?" Newspapers became suspicious, the grand complimentary speeches turned to sarcasm, and soon Field's representatives no longer let themselves be seen in public. And the cause of it all, increasingly frantic inside the Ireland transmission hut, was Edward O. Whitehouse. He was truly out of his element now, for everything Thompson had talked about was now coming true. Whitehouse's operators tapped in sharp signals, but they got blurry and spread out, becoming impossible to recognize by the time they'd crossed the Atlantic. Whitehouse did what any bully might do when he's been caught in a bluff. He panicked. He had installed big backup generators at great expense in the Ireland hut, devices 5 feet high like giant batteries that could blast into the cable great amounts, well, of what? Whitehouse thought that what came out of a battery was merely like the sparks from a welder's torch, only smaller. In later terminology, that a battery's job was just to launch fleets of powerfully charged electrons into the wire, which then tumbled forward all the rest of the way on their own. Thompson didn't believe that. In his view, what shot out from a battery was a wild, powerful force field. Feeding more battery powder into the undersea cable simply meant you were feeding in more of this howling field. That's why it was imperative, he'd explained, never to use the big batteries. Whitehouse ignored him. He was a tough, practical man who had made his own way up in English society. Strength had brought him this far, and strength would get him the rest of the way. There was nothing mysterious now either. The signal wasn't getting through, so, he felt, he just needed to force in more of the tiny particles that were pouring out from the metals of his battery. In the time-honored English tradition of speaking louder to a foreigner in the hope he'll understand you better if you shout, he told his underlings, now in these last weeks of August 1858, to hook up the 5-foot coils and let them rip.